Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July the 7th, 1999, and in Creekside Room this morning we have Bradley Hansen, Lutheran Spirituality Part 2, number 99-2. Let's listen in.
This is a series on Lutheran spirituality. I'm Brad Hansen, and this series is... This is the second in a series of what are going to be 9 sessions. The ideas here are based on a book that I've just completed and will be coming out in January of this next year. Yesterday we did kind of an overview, just talking about spirituality today. Not really talking anything specifically about Lutheran spirituality, although we did, there was some questions about whether there is such a thing as Lutheran spirituality, and talked about some definitions of that term. But basically talking about the cultural context in which people have lived today in the Western world and certainly in the United States. I didn't identify, well, what constitutes Lutheran spirituality. So I thought I would just start out with that today, because it's kind of a list of things, and in each of the sessions that is going to look at one of these characteristics. It seems to me that that Lutheran spirituality has really basically 7 characteristics to it. And each of these characteristics is, or nearly every one of them is, I think, shared by many other Christian traditions. But it seems to me that perhaps it is Lutheran spirituality that has, can't adjust that up, that has all 7 of them. So it's really the combination of these, I think, that together characterize Lutheran spirituality. And I'll maybe just go down quickly through these. Lutherans have a very kind of dark read of the human situation. Now, they're not the only ones that have this dark read. People from, say, from the Reformed tradition also tend to have a pretty dark read interpretation of the human condition. That's the subject actually for today. Secondly, the emphasis upon justification by grace, I think, is kind of the core of Lutheran spirituality, and I interpret it that way, trust that God's merciful grace undergirds all of life, and that will be the topic not tomorrow's, because we don't meet tomorrow, but on Friday's session. The third characteristic, I think, and this would be something that would be common to Protestants, is that we talk about how do we meet this God of mercy. Where does that God encounter us? Well, in, like other Protestant traditions, it is the Word, I think, that becomes the primary means. It is the Word expressed through words in various ways. That becomes the primary means of having contact with God. I mean, it's a simple thing such as just, all you have to do is just go to a Lutheran church service, or, well, maybe go to several, so over a month, okay? Go to a month's worth of church services at the Lutheran church. How often do you have communion? Well, at most Lutheran churches, you would not have it every Sunday. In some Lutheran churches, you might not have it at all. Yeah. But most Lutheran churches in this country, at least you'd have it once a month. Many now, they're beginning to be twice a month and moving towards probably every week weekly communion. I think that's kind of the direction of things. But we're not there yet. Or is over against, say, going to a Roman Catholic church every Sunday, every Mass. It is the Eucharist. And then the relative weight, the significance, you might say, given to the homily or the sermon. In a Roman Catholic church, it would be common to have, say, a 7-minute homily. Now, if Protestant Lutheran ministers, let's say, were to do that as a steady diet, you'd probably be in trouble with the church board, you know. Hey, you're laying down on the job here. A 15 to 20 minute sermon becomes much more the standard. So the reliance on the words of God, is the word of God in being expressed through words as the primary source of spiritual nurture. And yet, with Lutherans also, there's a confidence that God's grace is present through sacraments and through other physical symbols. And in that way, Lutherans are a little bit different, or significantly different, perhaps, from a number of other Protestant traditions. Yesterday I kind of drew this out, this little chart of church traditions here, Orthodox, Roman Catholic, Anglican, Lutheran, Reformed, Free Churches, such as Baptist. The further you get up here, the less significant sacraments have, the less significance really symbolism generally has, visual, tangible, physical symbols have. Whereas the traditions down here are very strong on that. And that becomes, for instance, the Roman Catholic tradition is primarily a sacramental tradition. It is the sacraments that are the primary means of grace. Word is expressed through words is secondary. Now, the Lutheran tradition, I think, is one in common with Protestants that it has the words as the primary means, but there is a substantial weight given to sacraments. Secondary, but still is substantial, and probably more so generally than some of these other Protestant traditions. See? And in that respect, in many ways, you see similarities here with the Anglican tradition as well, or the Episcopal tradition in this country. What I'm doing here is I'm just identifying what I regard as 7 characteristics of Lutheran spirituality, many of which are shared by other traditions, but I think it's the constellation, the grouping of them that distinguish Lutheran spirituality. It is a communal tradition, life of the church, responsibility for nurture of one another. That's a way, kind of very quick way of talking about the sense, I think, of the church as a community of believers, first of all, rather than being an institution that has a certain structure that is necessary or essential to that institution. It is primarily a community, but also a sense of this kind of priesthood of all believers. We're a tradition that I think has a deep commitment to core church traditions, such as the doctrine of the Trinity, and yet at the same time a freedom towards secondary matters. And I think yesterday I argued that in our contemporary cultural situation, I think I'll try to put this up a little bit so you folks can see it back there. That perhaps serves us well in our contemporary cultural situation. And then finally, that here I'm referring to kind of the two kingdoms, this conviction of God's being involved in all of life, whether or not we recognize it. And then calling people, and here's the idea of vocation, I think. In other words, you'll notice here that the notion of spirituality that I'm working with is a broader notion than is often the case. And this is one of the things we talked about yesterday, that so often, time and time again, people think of spirituality as kind of praying, certain kinds of spiritual, very religious kinds of activities. And now, I wouldn't want to say that those aren't a part of spirituality, but my understanding of the term spirituality, and there is no universally accepted definition of that term, and so you kind of have to be careful and watch how a person uses it, but the way I'm using it is that a spirituality is really a faith plus a path. And what it seems to me, the term, particularly in Lutheran circles, often is used, is it really refers only to the path sort of stuff, the certain practices. And it seems to me that those practices, though, don't have their significance and meaning unless you see them in the context of a certain faith, which brings its perspective, its certain interpretation of reality and of life, and also which is a living experience. And I think that's one of the things that draws people to the notion of spirituality, is that they're talking about a kind of lived, experienced faith, not something that is simply a kind of routine that they're going through. Well, that's a kind of quick, very quick kind of run through. Yes.
And I was really happy to hear your number six up there, because I don't know if this fits in here or not, but I grew up Roman Catholic, and so my first introduction to Lutheranism, Lutheran spirituality, was here in Poland. Uh-huh. And 20 years ago, John Trent introduced me to the term adiaphora, which I'd never heard before, but was extremely freeing. Does that seem to fit in your number six?
Oh, yeah, that's definitely, that's the term.
So
that, yeah.
You could disrespect other things because they were adiaphora, they were secondary. Didn't have to include them or not. Mm-hmm. And that was a very freeing term that I loved about this tradition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
I wondered about the last part of number four and what you're referring to there. It may also work through other physical symbols.
Well, there is the distinction between sacrament and sacramental.
Icons, using
sure.
An icon as
a oh, yeah.
Symbol to channel.
Yes. It can be a host of things. That is to say, a sacrament is something that is a physical symbol with has certain kinds of promises together with it. It's the way we've understood in our tradition sacrament, and if we've understood that there are only two sacraments. But the a sacramental can be almost anything that becomes a symbol of God's presence. And so that for this or that person, it doesn't have that sort of guarantee of the divine promise with it, but it becomes, perhaps in this or that situation, a medium of God's presence. So that, for instance, if you go out on a nature walk and you see this mammoth tree, and, you know, it impresses you with the kind of, this is 350 years old, you know, and that can be a symbol of God's presence. It doesn't have to be then, I don't think, something that's necessarily humanly made. It can be like icons. And so, for instance, this is where, again, I think the Lutheran tradition has this kind of mediating position in some ways, that that sacraments and physical symbols tend to take second place to words for us. And yet, my golly, they're still quite significant. If you look, if you go into Lutheran churches, a number of Lutheran churches, on the average, you know, we probably aren't going to have as many physical symbols present there as in an Orthodox church, certainly, or on average, a Roman Catholic church. But there will be more of them present than, say, in a Reformed church on average. So, And I have a thesis about that, which I'll argue when I get to that, that it seems to me that there is a relationship there between the attention given to sacraments in that narrower sense, and the significance given to symbols generally. And that now when we've had renewed attention to baptism in the last 25 years in the Lutheran Church in this country, and then now with more frequent communion occurring, I think we're going to find the effect of that over time is going to be that we will have a kind of livelier, richer appreciation of physical symbols generally. And maybe that's already occurring. It would be interesting to talk to people that have worked in religious art. Okay, any other comments on that?
Well, one point to that is that as in those last 20 years or so, as the Lutheran Church has kind of felt a little bit of the ripple effect of John 23rd and the opening of the Roman tradition.
Oh yeah.
Affected all of us really.
You bet.
And as we, as Lutherans, have come to see that communion should be part of our steady diet, if you take the kind of the flavor of the confessions and say we're an sacrament, we're an occasional sacrament.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes.
And the feeding of that for these 20 some years has rippled again through the archer. So I'm just undermining your point that mm-hmm. has for many of us become almost essential.
Mm-hmm.
And it does its own thing. Mm-hmm. It really encourages that both the oral tradition or the word tradition as well as the visible
mm-hmm.
side of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would you say that there's been a disconnect regarding church architecture and Lutheran piety or spirituality when you think that, historically, how often have they had communion? Maybe once a month, maybe once every 3 months, that sort of thing. How often is there a sermon every Sunday? And yet the altar is at the center stage, and the pulpit is usually off to the left or to the right. Where I serve, it's interesting because the pulpit is in the center with the altar in front. Mm-hmm. And it was very awkward at first, and I'm still not quite totally comfortable with it because it's so different. But I wonder if there has been a disconnect there.
Yeah, that could well be. That's an interesting question. I couldn't say for sure. It may be the fact that the placement of the altar there is a reminder, calling us back to, in our practice, doing something which perhaps we have not doing. Mm-hmm.
In European architecture, it's on the point that the altars, the high altars, the east wall altar, it's in an apse, it's very removed, and the pulpit is out, usually hanging on. Mm-hmm. Side, a column of some sort, or out front, so that the objective, the distant holy other is up there, and when we approach that, we're very careful time and so on. That's interesting how we're used to it, that it is almost like a
counter. The word is back, and it is in an apse of sort.
Yeah.
The pulpit is the weirdest place there.
Okay, well, as if you came in a little later, what I'm going to be doing is looking at these seven characteristics of Lutheran spirituality in the sessions. And the one that we're dealing with today is this first one, the serious, the really serious reading of the human condition that is a part of the Lutheran tradition. Now, this is not peculiar, I mean, it's not unique to Lutherans, but it certainly is something that has been significant for us and important for us, I think. Okay, so our topic is today the human condition. Spirituality, I think the whole subject of spirituality speaks to people in our sense of being on a journey, I think. You remember, I talked yesterday briefly about the fact that in closing that word spirituality is this term spiritual, and that that can mean a number of things, but one of the things I think is significant here is this, that we are able to transcend our immediate circumstances and to reflect on our situation, to ask questions about it, and to then ask questions of meaning. All right, now that human condition, then, or that kind of built-in, which we, I think, Christians interpret as a divinely given quality of human life. When we do that, when we reflect on our situation, seek and yearn and quest for meaning in a variety of ways, certain questions, I think, naturally arise. And I'll identify three questions. First being that, what are we meant to be? What are we intended to be? Second question is, what has gone wrong? And the third question is, what is needed to set things right? Okay? So, we'll just look briefly at those, kind of the Lutheran answer to those three questions. It seems to me that Lutherans share with great, I think most other Christians, the answers to the first two of those questions. What are we intended to be? Well, one of the ways that you could state that is to say that we are intended to be centrally devoted to God, and to have hearts centrally devoted to God, and to be caring toward other people and other creatures. Now, here I can put that down. I've got a little overhead I can use for that. To have hearts centrally devoted to God and caring toward other people and creatures. Now, I say, this is a standard Christian answer. But notice, this is one of those basic religious questions. And every religion or philosophy of life has implicitly or explicitly, I think, some read of what we are intended to be. And the Christian answer, shared by the Lutheran tradition, comes clearly, for instance, and it's stated in the Jesus' summation of the law, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Now, we've been light on that other creature's side, but we've got some pretty good stuff there, I think, in the Old Testament particularly that we can work with. The emphasis in our tradition has been upon a relationship with God and relationship with other people. The other creature's side of it has been more subdued. But it's something that I think we're learning and coming to emphasize more. Now, that's not the only answer that one could give to this question, but I think that's basically one way of summing up the Christian answer. What has gone wrong? Well, there's a variety of answers that are given to that. Some of them psychological, some of them having to do with, in modern culture, with ignorance. Ignorance has been regarded widely, I think, as one of the things that kind of plagues us as human beings. And if we could just have better education, have more knowledge, particularly knowledge in the sense of knowledge as gained through objective knowledge, through the scientific process, then we would be, we'd finally get things right. The Christian answer, I think, basically, though, has been that the most fundamental flaw in human existence is a breakdown in our relationship with God. Again, it fits with our read of the human condition that we are intended to be centrally devoted to God, have our highest, God as our highest priority, that which we love most of all. And what has gone wrong is somehow there has been a breakdown in our relationship with God. Now, this tends to be vulgarized, you might say, this kind of read. We so often tend to think only of sins rather than sin, you might say. That is, we tend to think of particular acts of wrongdoing. Whereas I think when we're talking here, we're talking about that basic underlying human condition. It would be like thinking about the difference between the having cancer and the symptoms of cancer. You see, if you only deal with the symptoms of cancer, that's just kind of the surface stuff. It's real, significant, but it's more the surface stuff. Whereas we're not just talking about particular acts of wrongdoing here, but what is the fundamental flaw, and that is a breakdown in our relationship with God. And then third question, like I say, I think on these first two answers, Luther's just kind of with nearly all other Christians, I think, on this stuff. What is needed to set things right? Well, here's where Lutherans tend to differ, not only Lutherans, but among Lutherans too. There have been different answers to this, that not only from other traditions, religious traditions or philosophical views, but also in Christianity. One of them says that since we're slow learners, God shows us the way and we're able to follow it. That was stated long ago by a guy named Pelagius, a monk around the year 400 or so. What does it mean? Well, it means that we've kind of lost our way, but that God gives us instructions through various ethical teachings, the Ten Commandments, for example, the ethical teachings of Jesus, and that so God kind of gives us some light, and that we are able, kind of lights the path a little bit for us, and we are able to follow the path. I think that is a conviction that probably is very common yet today. I think you find it today maybe in a form such as this, that it's very common for people to we understand ourselves quite often as people who are at a kind of spiritual buffet in which there are all sorts of entrees in the buffet, and we can kind of put together our own little meal by picking up this, that, or the other spiritual entree. But what really, in the reason it can work, that you can have people doing all these different combinations, putting together their own combinations, is that what underlies them all often is the conviction that, well, there's a kind of fundamental morality. And as long as we're living according to that fundamental morality, then the other stuff is really quite secondary. I think that's quite a common view today. All right? Now, a second view, it says that since we are weak, God helps us have faith, but we must do our part. This would probably be, in many ways, a mainstream view in the Christian tradition, that we are not able to kind of turn our lives around on our own. God must certainly help us. In fact, God must do the major part. But we also must do our part. It is kind of cooperative undertaking. Right? This has been a view, I think, that is represented by the Council of Trent and the Roman Catholic tradition. It is probably what would most Christians read. I think it's the most common view if you would sort of poll Christians. That's basically what we feel, that it is a kind of cooperative thing in which God does the most part, but we must do some little portion ourselves. It is that in that way. It is what most people would consider to be common sense, because we feel we are convinced that we have freedom in all matters. I mean, there's a that's very American, and perhaps maybe just very human, that we feel that we have freedom in all matters. Now, here's where I think the Lutheran read of what is needed to set things right goes in a different direction. And again, it's not just Lutherans, but it is them as well. It would, something like what I'm saying there, since we are distrustful, God's faithful presence enables us to trust her. What am I getting at? Well, two points here, really, that are significant, I think. One is that the whole business of reorienting one's life towards God is on a different level altogether than other matters in our life. Like, we're free to make decisions about, you know, what to eat for breakfast, given the options that are available. We're free whether we're going to come to Holden Village or not. We're free about, within, again, limits, about what kind of work we're going to do, who we're going to marry, or are we going to marry, stuff like that. I mean, there's many givens in our life, but there's a certain range of, in which our freedom can work within those limits, and we have choices, all right? Whereas I think Lutheran tradition says that this whole business of reorienting one's life towards God is on a different level. Now, I'll give you a couple of analogies here to try to suggest what I think the Lutheran tradition is saying. First of all, have you ever been in a situation where you're worried? You're very anxious and you're worried. And somebody says to you, don't worry. Now, can you just decide not to worry? Don't think so. I think worry or not worrying is not something that is subject to our volition. We're not able to kind of turn it off or turn it on. Or another... See, and it's suggesting there, what I'm suggesting with that analogy is saying there are some things about us, some dimensions of our experience, see, which are not subject to kind of choice. All right? That they operate on a different level than that. A second analogy. Imagine, let's say, a young girl, 8-year-old girl, who has been... abandoned by her family, right? And then shuttled around to various other members of the family network. And in that whole process has been abused, both physically and sexually, right? Now this is a young girl who doesn't trust anybody. She's learned not to trust people. She's the only one she can trust is herself. Okay. Now, you find out about this girl, and you're going to be her friend. And so you come up to her and you say, "Well, trust me." Is she going to trust you? No. And the point here is, I'll develop this a little further. The point is that it's not that she won't trust you so much, that because won't suggests that she, you know, if she decided to, I will trust you. Rather, I'm saying that I think she's strictly unable to trust you. At this point, she is strictly unable to trust you. All right. Now, let's say, though, that you stay by this person, okay? And over periods of months, perhaps years, you stand up for this person, you stay by her, you're loyal, even when she sort of tests the limits, you know, you stick with her. And perhaps after maybe a year or 2 years, it may be that that young girl will come to trust you. Right? Now, the point is that it seems to me that it's been your loyal, persistent, steady, faithful presence that has enabled her to trust you. See? So that at this point, yes, she, at, you know, let's say after a year, she does come to trust you, and she will then perhaps have this consciousness of choosing to trust you. At this point, but what has made that possible? What has made it possible is your faithful relationship with her over a period of time. You see, you have enabled her to trust you. Now, I'm using that as an analogy for our relationship with God, for being able to reorient our life towards God. That I think the Lutheran read of our situation is that we are unable, just like that distrustful girl, we are unable to reorient our life towards God. And what makes it possible is God's faithful presence over time. In various ways. That, and so that we may then become conscious at some point in our experiences, yes, kind of deciding, choosing God as well. But what has made that possible is God's presence. See, God has enabled us to, freed us to do that. And it seems to me that that is the Lutheran read on the human situation. It's a little, it's darker, you might say, and than many other Christian interpretations. It's darker than certainly what is common sense and widely accepted in our culture, where we believe that yes, we can reorient our life in whatever way we wish. We can mold it and direct it, redirect it however we wish. This, I think, though, it is important to talk about, because it is one of those presuppositions for the whole matter about talking about grace, which comes next. Now, what I'd like to do is to have us do a little reflective exercise here, and using... I'm going to pass out Bibles here. We'll make use of the Bible and also I'll use something else from Luther's Small Catechism. And we've got a few more here yet. Okay. Anybody else? Everybody got one yet? We've got some more here. Just pass it back. Okay, thanks. Reflect on is the first commandment and Luther's explanation to it. And what I'm trying to find is my overhead with Luther's explanation on it. Husky little thing has seemed to slip out of my sight here. The first commandment, you shall have no other gods. And then Luther's brief, very brief, explanation of that. Now, what we should remember that this first commandment is given, we should remember the context in which it's given. It's in the 20th chapter of Exodus, is it? Start of that chapter.
And God spoke all these words, saying, "The Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, you shall have no other gods."
Okay, yes. Now notice the context. I'm the God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. What has just preceded this giving of the law in the biblical story here?
The Exodus.
The Exodus, the deliverance from the bondage in Egypt. Okay. Now, so it's within that context of God remembering their suffering, remembering their situation, and doing something to liberate them from that situation. It's in that context that this command is given. Now, so, what I'd like you to do is the following. Is take maybe 7-8 minutes to reflect on this and say, what connections if any do the first commandment the biblical context, remembering that context, and Luther's explanation, what connections do they make with your life? Your life and world. So I'd like you just to reflect on that, kind of ponder. It's a time of meditation, using those few words. And then we'll have a time for sharing together in small groups and all together as well. Is everybody clear about that? Anybody puzzled about what you're to do?
Did you want us to read it out of here or just think of that?
Well, you can use it from there, you can read it from there, either one. You wouldn't have Luther's explanation that's up here. So it may be more helpful to use the biblical rendering of it because it gives you the context or reminds you of the context, that first paragraph.
What was it?
Exodus 20. In that first several verses, right, is a paragraph, the kind of opening paragraph there. First two verses. Okay. Any other questions about? Well, that's not a very long time. Not long enough, but perhaps we're running short on time for the hour. So let's just see if you have any, I guess rather than putting in small groups, it's see if you have any reflections, things you want to share, observations you want to make, anything that came out of that meditation, and questions you may have. Yeah, man.
I think this is a reflection of the time and place I live in, but the part that's always hardest for me about that is the fear part. The trust and love of God bring really close to experience, but starting with this, your first obligation is to fear God. Is always a tough one for me. And then part of it also reflects on which side of the Exodus story I put myself in. Am I part of the Egyptians who just were pursuing them and drowned in the Red Sea, or am I part of the people who have just been liberated? And I, probably a lot of where I live in the world, they put me more in the camp of the Egyptians, although I want to identify with the Israel. But the trust and the love of God rings clear, but the fear of God is a harder one for me to connect with as a duty.
Anybody else have anything to say about that?
I guess this is a fear for me. It's almost like in fact, we're just doing a sermon series on this. I just got through wrestling with this text a few weeks ago, and I said then that God is an intolerant God.
Mm-hmm.
The God won't put up with any other gods. Just won't have it. You know. That when I go chasing off after other gods, which I do, you know, that there are places where I get drawn off, then things get really messy. Mm-hmm. Things start falling apart, and it's not what God wants for me. And there's something. Is there a fear thing in there? Is there consequence? Yeah, there is.
that evokes, I guess, some shape or form of fear. It's not all okay.
Dan, how does that sit with you, Dan, or not?
No, it makes a lot of sense, but I also, I guess it's partly with different images I have of God, because the parental image of God, and it may come from a different time, but I don't fear my parents. I fear disappointing them. I fear letting them down. I trust and love them. I sort of think more of the story of the prodigal son image. And I may be misreading the term fear. It may be more something like respect or revere, something along those lines. But I remember as a child being told, you know, the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. It's like, oh. Yeah. It was not true in my own experience.
And No, I suspect that it really tends, is supposed to mean more reverence or revere, and so a kind of sense of awe for God, which would be appropriate. But you're right. I think for us, and maybe in an earlier era, the word fear did have that meaning in people's minds. But for us, we think of fear as terror, really, don't we?
When I go back and forth, I think partly because of the parental image between, you know, on the one hand, coming out of a tradition that says, you know, children are to be seen, not heard, kind of things, you know, and that sort of fear of the authorities and respect and stuff. But also, time and again in the gospel stories, that, you know, that Jesus represented, that Jesus' words comes out of the mouth of infants, who rebuke the children, they rebuke me. So there's that kind of funny tension between that relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dorothy?
Yeah, I just thought I was just struck, because that's exactly what I was thinking. It occurs to me, that I was having trouble with the word fear, it occurs to me now, if you think about this kind of parallelism between fearing, loving, and trusting God, in contrast to all other things. And we know we're not supposed to love other things, especially, you know, more than God, or trust them when we trust God. But we also shouldn't fear them, those things. There'd be something missing in that second part of the parallel if fear weren't there, because we're not, you know, we really do fear, love, and trust God. If that's the only God, then, you know, the empire won't scare us to death, right? The forces of evil, which may kill us, won't terrify us so greatly that we're, you know, we fall down before them. So, in a sense, that parallelism. Oh,
that's that's interesting. That's very good. Yeah, thank you. Did any of you, yes, Kim?
Well, I was not focusing so much on the fear piece or Luther's piece. I was trying to focus on the commandment itself and what it and how it stands presently for me, just as it stands. And I was trying to think, really completed in thinking, but the first commandment is like a goal and a critique. The goal is to have no other God. And it's the first one in the primal commandment, and everything is Jesus falls from it. So as I'm taking it as a human being, it becomes for me a goal. And then it's the critique, from which I try to figure it out, it becomes the critique for my living in a way that I, in fact, do have other gods. They are there. And so it's both the goal and the judge at once. And maybe I've become taught too many confirmation classes. I don't know, but the whole point is to drag you to Christ, because the only way that can shift from being a goal to something richer and more meaningful is seeing it through the life of Christ, for me anyway. That's kind of about as far as I got.
What would it be like experientially to have no other gods? What would it be like for us? So that's not only a question for you, Kemp, but for everybody.
Yeah, sure. And I don't want to hog this thing, but maybe there's confession is good for the soul. I had a boyhood dream to own a sports car. And so I've been working on this for about the last 10 years, and I'm in a part of my career where midlife crisis, and you kind of want to say, well, I better do it now if I'm going to do it at all. So I did, and I had the love affair with this car, but on the other hand, every time I get in it, I feel guilty as hell. And so my wife is trying to be the Christ figure here and help me through this.
Hey, you giving up the car?
No.
What would it be like? I mean, were any of you there at the early breakfast when Wes Prieve gave his morning devotions? And I don't know if he did the same, a similar thing at the second, a little later on or not. But he talked really basically about peace, didn't he? My peace I give to you. And isn't that what happens when somehow we're able to really have God first in our life? It's not that we don't love or care for other things, but to love God above every other thing. Then it seems to me that then there is a kind of peace that comes.
When anything becomes an obsession, isn't that a false god? And I think in our society, we're bombarded with, you have to do this or you're going to die, or you can't do this or you're going to die, mm-hmm. or you have to eat this, or you have to exercise like this, and then it becomes like an obsession.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that is kind of like a false god.
Okay.
Because when you become so obsessed with something like that,
mm-hmm.
and it just seems to me that we're always being bombarded.
And what's the effect upon a person's life when you're obsessed with these things?
Distraction?
Focus.
Sure.
Focus is wrong.
Yeah, and you're kind of scurrying around like this, right? My image of the Christian life would be if there were no other God in our life, that we would be sort of like we would be truly centered, and that we would be able to love and to care and be actively engaged in a whole variety of ways, but there would be that kind of divine center there that would kind of keep us steady, you might say. And but that we, of course, when we get other gods, we wobble. And we're kind of going off this way, that way. And you lose that kind of steadiness, that sense of peace, I think. And it's something in which, of course, we never have a capture on. We're never able to kind of hold it. But it's something that I think that when it comes, it is a real, real gift. I was just thinking, and part of it the key to think to it is attachment. That is, we become overly attached, and that connects with your obsession thing. For instance, this spring, I was concerned about my son finding a suitable job. And I would wake up in the middle of the night, and I'd be awake about it, and I'd toss and turn. And then it dawned on me after several days that, why is this bothering me so much? It's because I'm placing that kind of, I'm attached to a certain kind of outcome that unless that outcome happens, I can't really be happy. Well, there's something wrong about that, isn't there? You could go on, and I'm sure give lots of instances from your own experience about that. I found that, for instance, when I faced cancer, had cancer surgery in October of 94. And the most difficult, I was, you know, I felt like I was ready to die, if that was necessary. But what I found difficult was giving up more time with my wife and my children. Everything else I was ready to let go of, but those two I was not. And I prayed about that for some months, asking God to somehow let me let go of them. And didn't happen. And I visited with my pastor, and he said, well, you know, St. Paul wasn't sure either, you know, whether it was better to be away with the Lord or here. Maybe, you know, just live with that. And, yeah, that makes sense. So I stopped praying to, you know, for that. And then about, I think it must have been about 5 months later, it happened. That there was a kind of letting go that happened. And there's a freedom about that. And there's a peace about it. I think our time is up. Thanks.
Thank you.